Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Captain Hunter's Podcast. Thank you so much for tuning in. Thank you for your love, your support. Please make sure that you rate, subscribe, and share these episodes. Rate the episodes highly. Subscribe to the episodes so that you make sure that you get notified whenever there is a new episode that comes out. Usually, as you all know, I try to drop the episodes every Sunday. So we're going to keep on going with that. So just make sure that you rate, subscribe, and that you share. Today's episode, we got a good one for you. We're going to talk about sentencing reform. Ms. Kara Gotch from the Sentencing Project. You all may have heard of that organization, sentencingproject.org. Check out that website. Ms. Gotch is someone that I met at a drug reform conference in St. Louis in November 2019. I was very impressed by the words that she spoke. She was one of the panelists. Just gave a great speech about the harm that mass incarceration has done to the community. In particular, of course, as the drug reform conference, they want to legalize and decriminalize marijuana and many other drugs. So she was there speaking on behalf of that and the nexus between this mass incarceration, the war on drugs, and she also addressed how it affects many communities, and not just communities of color, but all communities. So I reached out to Ms. Scotch, and she was very kind to be a guest on the show. And she's a very busy lady, and she managed to squeeze me into her schedule, and I certainly appreciate that. So let's get into the episode. Here's a little bit about Ms. Kara Gotch. She is the Director of Strategic Initiatives. As Director of Strategic Initiatives, Kara Gotch oversees the Sentencing Project's federal advocacy work and develops special projects and partnerships to advance the organizational mission of reducing mass incarceration. Gotch returned to the Sentencing Project in 2016 after serving as its Director of Advocacy from 2005 to 2012. When she helped lead the multi-year effort to reform the notorious 100-to-1 crack cocaine sentencing disparity that resulted in the 2010 passage of the Fair Sentencing Act. Her sentencing reform advocacy was honored in 2011 by Congresswoman Maxine Waters. Prior to her return, Gotch led the Interfaith Criminal Justice Coalition, a project of the United Methodist Church, General Board of Church and Society, comprised of 50 national faith-based organizations. The coalition organized faith leaders and clergy to advance federal criminal justice reforms, particularly around issues of sentencing, re-entry, and collateral consequences of incarceration. Gotch has also worked for the National Prison Project of the American Civil Liberties Union, overseeing media outreach, public education, and federal legislative activities. She concluded her tenure there, bringing international attention to the issues of prison rape in Texas. Gotch received her undergrad degree from Binghamton University and a master's in public policy from the University of Maryland. I'm really looking forward to this conversation with Ms. Gotch. Please make sure that you go over to sentencingproject.org. Here you can read a number of her articles that she has written. You can also sign up for emails through them. And without further ado, ladies and gentlemen, here is the interview with Ms. Kara Gotch. Thank you so much. I'm speaking with Kara Gotch from the Sentencing Project. Thank you so much for being on Captain Hunter's Podcast.
You're welcome. My pleasure.
So I did read your bio to the audience. Now, would you just tell us a little bit more about yourself and what you actually do?
So most of my work here at the Sentencing Project involves federal advocacy around sentencing reform, reentry issues, drug policy reform, and addressing the collateral consequences of incarceration. So I work with a coalition of advocates here in Washington, D.C. to try and advance legislation to improve relationships with the U.S. Sentencing Commission and the sentencing guidelines, and really sort of make sure that Congress is hearing from people directly impacted by the system. And we work with people on the ground, grassroots advocates, to make sure that they're contributing to the democratic process.
Okay. So I'm very interested in how much resistance you get from, I would say, more conservative people concerning that what you do.
Well, you know, it's mixed. You know, the conversation around criminal justice issues has really shifted. There is bipartisan interest in addressing reform. From conservatives, you know, it depends on what we're talking about. I mean, at the federal level, we talk a lot about drug policy and reducing mandatory minimums or eliminating mandatory minimums for drug offenses because drugs, you know, 50% of the people in federal prison are there for a drug offense. And, you know, I would say 10 years ago, I might be laughed out of a Republican office, if I said, you know, I want to get rid of mandatory minimums for drugs. I think now there's definitely more receptivity to that. I mean, not that there's a rush to end mandatory minimums, but certainly there is agreement that the sentences are too long, that the mandatory minimums for drug offenses at the federal level are too long, and that they need to be reduced. And I mean, and that was, you know, supported clearly in the First Step Act, although that was limited, I think there's a lot more that can be done. You know, the public has become really educated around mass incarceration and long sentences, and lawmakers are hearing from them. They definitely need to hear from them more. But, you know, I think Republicans know that this is an issue and that they can't just dismiss our concerns out of hand because of the sort of, even despite the tough on crime eras of the 80s and 90s.
Do you think a lot of that, willingness to go along with it is because they see it as unfair or because they see the financial impacts that it has?
I think it's both. I think people assume that it's only a financial interest, but quite frankly, at the federal level, the cost of the Bureau of Prisons is just a drop in the bucket when you compare it to the entire, you know, federal budget of trillions and trillions of dollars, right? I mean, yeah, it's a lot. $7 billion to run the federal prison system is a lot, but in context, the feds have deep pockets. At the state level, it's definitely more, I would say, financial issues, concerns, expenses are definitely way higher because corrections is a much bigger budget item in state budgets. That's not so much true for the federal stuff. What I found to be most persuasive, you know, I used to work before my recent stint with the Sentencing Project, I worked for the United Methodist Church in a coalition of faith organizations and worked on criminal justice reform and sentencing. And the faith community and moral perspectives on justice and our criminal justice system are very effective, both with Democrats and Republicans, but particularly with Republicans who like to hold themselves up as being very motivated in their faith. And, you know, this is the language of the mainstream, you know, the Abrahamic faith traditions is very much steeped in rehabilitation and redemption and acknowledging people's self-worth and the sacred worth of all people. And so that lends itself very well to prison reform and criminal justice reform. And it was very effective having clergy and faith leaders, for example, in the state of Iowa, weigh in with Chuck Grassley, who was previously the chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee and an opponent of sentencing reform. And it was that faith perspective about the need to not cast people as irredeemable that really moved him to support sentencing reform. And he insisted that the First Step Act, which passed in December, include sentencing reform. I mean, you might remember when it first passed the House, there was not a stitch of sentencing reform in there. And it was Chuck Grassley who convinced the president that it had to be there if it was going to be successful.
Now, that's interesting, the faith tradition that guides people. And so you were part of a board or society of different, I would assume, church organizations, denominations?
Yeah, well, I worked for the United Methodist Church, but I convened a coalition, an interfaith coalition of religious organizations. So it was people and organizations from various denominations that came together.
Was that a large organization? I'm very curious as to
the coalition. There were about 50 national religious organizations and denominations that were part of the coalition.
That's interesting. I plan to do another episode on the role of churches particularly the Black church, which in my estimation has failed a lot of social activism since the 1960s, but we don't have to go down that road. So it's very interesting to hear. It's very interesting to hear, that, you know, you were part of an organization that was trying to do that. Now you just deal with federal sentencing guidelines. Is that right? Do you?
Well, the Sentencing Project doesn't. The Sentencing Project, you know, does advocacy at the state and federal level. Our research is focused on state and federal issues. Most of my advocacy work, though, is centered at the federal level.
Now, how did you get into this line of work? Did you always have a sense for prison reform, criminal justice reform? What brought you to this?
You know, when I was young, like in high school, I was very active in death penalty abolition. I was part of Amnesty International as a student. I really felt how important it was that the government not be involved in killing people, and continued to be a very strong death penalty abolitionist. And from that experience, where I was really engaged in advocacy, grassroots advocacy in that work, I sort of made an easy transition to prison reform work, and I started working at the ACLU's National Prison Project, which is a primarily litigation office that which represents people who are incarcerated and seeks to improve conditions of confinement in prisons. I, have always believed that everyone deserves to be treated humanely and that we all deserve respect. And, you know, people who are incarcerated don't have the benefit of public scrutiny, public oversight. What happens behind bars happens behind bars, and the public doesn't know about it. And that was always concerning to me because of that kind of environment is ripe for opportunities for abuse. And that does happen, right? Lots of abuse, mistreatment, inadequate conditions of confinement, unconstitutional conditions of confinement go on because the average citizen can't just walk up to the prison door and says, I want to come in here and inspect what's going on. And that's a real problem. But over the years in that experience of going into prisons and talking to people who are incarcerated and hearing about the trauma that they experience on a day-to-day basis and really understanding who those people were. I mean, I had access to case files and that kind of thing. And, you know, too many times I came across people who had below average IQs, not just below average, but, you know, IQs that border, in the 70s, right, who were day-to-day, you know, had no front teeth because they had been knocked out or
oh god,
they had been abused, and no one was protecting them. And the reason they couldn't get out is because they were always, you know, they could never make parole because they were always getting in fights. And I would look at these folks, and I would say, god, you should not be here. You know, they might go in for a minor offense, and they just can't get out of the system because they're constantly being targeted and victimized. And prisons are full of people like that, people who should not have been there, who are being harmed by their continued incarceration. And I knew at that point, when I sort of finally came to this realization, we can't fix our prisons. It's just impossible. And so I knew I wanted to stop people going to prison, and that's how I came to the Sentencing Project. Because the goal for me is really to stop the flow of people going into prisons, because there's too much harm. Prisons cause too much harm and too much trauma, and there's never going to be, at least in the way we think about prisons in this country, a humane prison.
Right. Because of the work that is done by so many prison inmates, do you think that prison abolition in its entirety will ever be able to stop all prisons? I mean, they do so much work, they're answering phone calls and all, making whatever they make. And
I think anything's possible if our society's sort of mentality shifts. I think there's a reason we have mass incarceration and corporations can profit off of incarceration is because our society allows it to happen and says it's okay. I think in other countries where they don't have the death penalty, they don't have extreme sentences, and people's incarceration is not seen as a scarlet letter for the rest of their life. I think it's because a very different society lives there that values people from birth, that invests in their communities, has a completely different social safety net than we have in this country. That it's up to us as citizens to demand the sort of country we want and society we want and communities we want. So I think it's possible if we, you know, make sure children get what they need, that they're, you know, getting the education and the opportunity and the access that they need to care, both medical and otherwise, that will contribute to reductions in crime. It will address substance, help to address avoiding substance use disorder. People get the care they need before they turn to things like that. And then there will be no need for prisons, right? if we have a society that we take care of each other.
Why do you think that we have had this mass incarceration? I have my own thoughts, but I'd like to hear why you think that since the 60s or 70s, we had that boom in federal and state prisons.
I mean, there's lots of reasons, right? There's structural racism, there's poverty, there's lack of you know, we don't have universal health care in this country. There's not access to treatment on demand. And we've made our office holders, our policymakers have made conscious decisions to address our social problems with a punitive response rather than a more holistic response. And I mean, those were deliberate decisions that were made, many times fueled by racism or bias, or, you know, a lack of compassion, perhaps.
I often get pushback when I say things like that, so I'm glad that someone else is saying it. That no, seriously, because people say, listen, your show has become too racial. But if we're going to solve society's ills and problems, then I completely agree with you. We have to solve these other problems. And one of the biggest problems we have to take a look at as a country is to say, what started all this kind of stuff, right? We'll never get to the end if we don't start at the beginning and then break down all these systems and programs that, as you said, we have initiated for a variety of reasons. What I would say, and I would agree with structural racism, capitalism, and just this desire for more money, and somebody's got to feed the machine, the greed. And so, so that creates these problems. I think it's a terrible thing. So thank you for saying it. So that's another voice out there just kind of backing up what I'm saying.
Glad to be there for you.
So one of your definitive works was the Fair Sentencing Project. Would you say that was one of your greatest accomplishments?
The Fair Sentencing Act?
Yes, Fair Sentencing Act, yes.
Yeah, I mean, in many ways, that bill was such a breakthrough. It was a huge breakthrough. I mean, it's funny, you know, the First Step Act, which just passed in December, that's, you know, the reason why it was called the First Step Act is because they wanted to show that, you know, this was just the beginning, that there was going to be more, which is a sentiment I appreciate, right? I mean, there has to be more work done to improve everything, conditions, our system of justice in this country. But really, I mean, the Fair Sentencing Act, which was passed in 2010, was the first time Congress had eliminated a mandatory minimum, had acted in decades to try and reduce sentences at all. You know, before the Fair Sentencing Act, Congress was only increasing sentences, right? So this was a brand new concept of actually reducing sentences. And it was a lot, what was particularly important about that, because a lot of times as advocates, we get confronted with from pollsters and people who do public opinion research that talk messages around race are not effective for the public. and that we should avoid those messages around racial disparity and racism that's structural and racism that's inherent in the system. And with the crack cocaine disparity, which is the 100-to-1 disparity, you couldn't talk about that without talking about race. And we tried, right? I mean, we tried to be responsive to what the pollsters were telling us, that lawmakers don't want to talk about race. And I remember going into a Republican office probably in 2005 to give our pitch on why the 100-to-1 disparity in sentencing for crack and powder was so wrong, right? And saying, you know, it's not a federal, you're bringing for people going to prison for crack offenses, the drug quantity is so low, we're bringing in people who are very low level, primarily people with substance use disorders, you know, we're talking about a sugar packet or two amount of crack cocaine. These people are not high level federal cases, and the government shouldn't be spending time on these people dealing with such small amounts of drugs. And at the end of this pitch by my colleagues and I, the staffer said, yeah, but what about the racial disparity? And we're like, well, yeah, there's that too. And it persuaded them. I mean, you know, between 80 and 90% of the people in prison, even now for federal crack offenses, are African American, right? How can you not talk about this injustice without also talking about race? And it was just so important. And I think that was a really good message to say, let's not shy away from that. I mean, when I reflect back on like the floor speeches in the House that members made, and we had a lot of Republican members talk on the floor, all of them talked about the racial disparity and how it was a symbol for racial injustice in this country, and that they could not do something. Now, did they do everything we wanted? No, it was a half measure. They just reduced the disparity. They didn't eliminate it. But it was refreshing to hear consensus that there was racial injustice in our criminal justice system, and they were going to at least attempt to make some amends for that.
Oh, that is refreshing to hear. I was at a forum here in Connecticut where we were trying to legalize marijuana. Now, I gave the law enforcement aspect on it, obviously, as retired law enforcement. I gave their representative from law enforcement. And as I'm talking to the people, I was very cognizant of the fact that I didn't want to solely focus on the fact that there were racial aspects to how many people were being stopped and arrested for the possession of marijuana in comparison to white people. Even though I try not to harp on that. When I met with someone after that, they said I should have pushed it more. So it's very surprising. This was a white female who was saying, you really should have pushed that more. I'm like, really? Does that really resonate with people, with white people, that there is a racial, that the disparity has affected and afflicted the black community more than the white community? And she seems to think so. You seem to be saying that it's okay to kind of mention this thing, you know, because I want to be the type of person who just says it affects all Americans. But if we need to separate it, we need to separate it.
Yeah. I mean, you know, it's not that we should just say it, but we must say it, right? I mean, it's disingenuous to anyone's comprehension of why we have the mass incarceration problem in this country that we do. I mean, race is part of the equation. And so to have the conversation and not talk about it and not name it, then your audience is not going to fully understand what the problem is or why we're in the situation we're in.
Mm. You mentioned before that you looked at other countries as far as their criminal justice system. Do you do a comparison as mostly first world country, European countries, Finland, Sweden, England? Whatever, do you do comparisons and say, hey, listen, this is what they do to treat their drug addicts. This is what they do to treat their criminal offenders. And here's what we do in the United States. Do you measure those two out?
Yeah, we try and make comparisons with other countries. You know, my organization is involved in a campaign called Campaign to End Life Imprisonment. No other country uses life imprisonment to the extent that we do in this country. Most industrialized countries cap their sentences around 20 years. Life without parole is a really foreign concept, you know, to them. It's a common concept here, but it's not prevalent in most places. So I think it's helpful, you know, to put the United States in context. We are so unique and exceptional in our use of incarceration in this country and our overuse of it. That it's, I think, an important reminder. But, you know, we've been saying that for generations now, and it hasn't moved the needle as much as one would hope. You know, when there are periodic reviews of by the United Nations, either on the Committee to End Racial Discrimination or in other UN committees, you know, they repeatedly talk about the problems, the racial injustice in our criminal justice system, the problems with our criminal justice system, and it doesn't seem to move our government in the ways one would hope. So I think it's important for people to fully understand the problem of that we are in the United States, to know that this we are exceptional. But unfortunately, that doesn't, in the United States, we're very centric, self-centric. We hold ourselves separate from the rest of the world. And so there's not as much shame as one would hope.
Which is crazy. So I guess you have to convince people. I mean, you're able to convince, I believe you said Chuck Grassley before, about the using his own religious affiliations almost against him. Can you convince people, anyone who's listening to this, who's lost a family member, let's just say to murder, and you any sentencing guidelines that you would propose, you as the Sentencing Project would propose, or anyone else, saying that you only get 20, 25 years in comparison with other industrialized countries, how would you convince that person that it's okay not to give this person life without parole in comparison to 20, 25 years?
You know, I mean, I wouldn't pretend to try and tell a victim or survivor of particularly a violent crime how to feel, right? And I think anyone's reaction to the person who committed a crime against them or a loved one is going to be very emotional. And I get that, and I wouldn't expect them to feel any other way. So I wouldn't expect them that I could convince them of much of anything, because people are entitled to their own feelings. But I think if one were to look at the issues in a less emotional way, which I know would be hard for a victim, but if someone is a lawmaker, they have to look at things without prejudice, and they need to look at things without bias and just look at the facts. And the facts are, we know crime, by and large, including violent crime, is committed by young people who have not reached full maturity in their brain function, right? They have poor impulse control compared to adults. Their decision-making isn't as grounded. You know, that matters in understanding why people commit crime, particularly horrendous crime. But what we also know from our brain science and from decades of research, criminological research, is that people age out of crime. And so 10, 20 years after someone committed an offense, they are a profoundly different person just by simple maturity. And their likelihood of committing another crime is significantly, significantly diminished. And we're not protecting public safety by continuing to incarcerate that individual. Now, it might feel good from a retributive, perspective. Like, I want this person to suffer, right? But is that really what our criminal justice system is about? I mean, first and foremost, it is about protecting the public. I don't see how the public is protected by incarcerating people who are in their 50s, 60s, 70s, and 80s. I know they're not going to commit another crime, because that's what the research tells me, or the likelihood of them committing a crime is very, very small. And so for those people who are not a threat to public safety, and knowing that they are changed individuals after long periods of time in prison, 10, 20 years, they deserve a chance to begin again. They can't take back the harm they've caused. They can try and restore some of that harm. They can never completely restore it, but they should be given a chance to restore it to some extent and begin their life anew. You know, we can't, it's, for my mind, it's hard for me to hold someone accountable for the rest of their life because of a horrible mistake they made when they were 18. Because when they are 38, they're not that same 18-year-old. And we've got to acknowledge that and appreciate that and give people a second chance.
I think that what you said concerning the way that the United States views itself as being so different is really going to be a tough sell for people. In 1992, there was a police officer killed in the city that I live in and that I eventually became a police officer at, Waterbury, Connecticut. And for 20 plus years, they had a memorial on the night that he was killed. And very recently, I would say within the last 5 years before I retired, they brought him to court because they wanted to, I guess, continue with his life sentence. Actually, he received the death sentence, and then Connecticut repealed the death sentence, so they wanted to commute it to a life without parole. And all of the police officers, many police officers, retired and current officers, showed up in court in a show of solidarity, obviously, along with the family. And it actually did kind of touch my heartstrings, at a number of levels, because we had a lot of officers showing solidarity, obviously, for the loss of a life of a fellow officer. But also, I also had a lot of compassion for him because it was over 20 years ago. He obviously was not the same person. He had lost so much weight. He was dragged, he's dragged in shackles and this, that, and the other. And I know that this is a tough sell for people to see the harm that he's caused, the life that he's lost, that he caused to be lost. And on one side, and the other side, you see this person who, as you were just said, that he's not the same person that he was these years ago. Therefore, there was a tearing in me at that time when I was in court watching this whole scene go down. So I think that that's really going to be an uphill battle to convince people.
I think is so important to this whole movement is people understanding that people who are in prison are they're just people, They're not some different species. They are just people who have broken the law. But that doesn't have to define the rest of their life and their entire life until they die. And I think if people are given, I think if people in the community have more opportunity to be in contact, to be in connection with someone who's incarcerated, they have a better understanding of like what is going on and what really the consequences are of mass incarceration. I think that is what's most effective in changing hearts and minds is people just going in and connecting with being in community with people who are incarcerated and understanding that they're just like all of us.
Back to this racism thing, do you think that this idea of mass incarceration, these length of prison sentences, is really just a throwback to keeping certain populations, number one, out of the public, and number two, feeding that machine that they needed for capitalism, for getting things done, slavery in a sense, the 13th Amendment?
I certainly think bias and racism has played a role in, the criminal justice system throughout the criminal justice system, and it continues to pervade it. Even as reform has made some advancement, it has not significantly reduced racial disparity in the justice system. We still, African Americans are still five times more likely to be incarcerated than white Americans. I think that it's helpful to have organizations like Black Lives Matter in this conversation and other civil rights organizations part of this conversation to remind lawmakers, policymakers, the public about how our history informs our current policymaking and that one cannot separate the other, and that we have to be fully informed about that history as we move forward. To make change, even in the criminal justice context, because often people are not connecting the dots. As far as the role of capitalism, it's not just private for-profit making corporations that benefit from mass incarceration. It's also the Public Correctional Officers Union that, and communities in rural communities who are fighting to get that public prison built in their town because they've lost all industry. Factories have closed, coal mines are shutting down. I think it's problematic that we think it's okay to build a livelihood on incarceration, and that is really, this happens all the time in Congress, you know, regardless of party affiliation, members of Congress celebrate when their town in their district is chosen for the siting of a prison, because they said this is going to be a huge boom to our economy, and isn't this great for the future of our families and our community? And I'm like, isn't that sad that we want to build this community on the backs of people who are incarcerated? That should not be something that's ever celebrated. And if we can finally put profit and economic interests behind the interests of people, we would be doing a lot of good if we could sort of reshift those priorities.
I can tell that you have a lot of care in your words, and I appreciate what you're saying. I really do. I appreciate it. All right, so I guess we'll kind of end it there. What initiatives can we look forward to from the Substance Abuse Project and from you in particular going forward that are you pushing right now? What's hot on the plate right now for you?
So our big priority is advancing second look legislation, both at the federal level and at the state level. This summer, Senator Cory Booker and Congresswoman Karen Bass from California introduced the Second Look Act, which would allow judges to revisit a sentence for potential release or sentence reduction for people who've served at least 10 years. They would review their conduct in prison and the circumstances of their incarceration and make a decision on whether, given who that person is now, 10 years later, whether they should be considered for a sentencing reduction. And there is no exclusions based on offense type. People who are 50 years old or older would have a presumption of release, given what we know about aging out of crime phenomenon. States and jurisdictions across the country are also looking at laws like this. In the District of Columbia, we're optimistic in the next couple of months the district council will pass legislation to allow people who committed their crime under the age of 25, they would be given a chance for a sentence reduction after serving 15 years. They already have a second look law, but those are only for people who committed their offense under the age of 18. So this law, the new bill would extend that to age 24. So yeah, we're really hoping to get the lawmakers to focus more on the wisdom of long sentences and hopefully give opportunities for people to get out of prison who are facing life sentences.
Very nice. And what can people, the listeners out there, do to support the Sentencing Project and you?
I encourage you to go to our website, sentencingproject.org, or our Campaign to End Life Imprisonment website at endlifeimprisonment.org.
Very nice. Thank you so much, Kara Gotch. I said that right?
That's right. Thank you so much.
Okay, thank you. I'd like to have you back on again.
Absolutely.
Let's see where we're at. Okay. Thank you so much again,
Kara Gotch. Thank you. Take care.
Okay. Bye.
Bye.
Thank you so much to Kara Gotch for being on Captain Hunter's podcast. Please make sure that you all go over to thesentencingproject.org. Ms. Gotch has a number of articles that she has written, so check out her articles. There's also a tab called Take Action. And that tab, you can make your voice heard, you can donate, and you can join local efforts. So please make sure that you check that out and do everything you can to help them out. So that's it, ladies and gentlemen. I hope you guys enjoyed this episode. Please make sure that you rate, subscribe, and share. Whatever platform you're listening to Captain Hunter's podcast on, please make sure that you share it with your friends. Share it on Twitter, share it through email, tell your friends about it when you're at that dinner party. subscribe to the episodes, and that you like the episodes. Write me back on the email, cptlhunter@gmail.com. cptlhunter@gmail.com. Instagram, cptlhunter. Facebook, that's Lawrence Hunter. Twitter, cptlhunter. Remember that you can support the podcast through Venmo, through Cash App, through PayPal. All three of those are cptlhunter, Captain L. Hunter, Lawrence Hunter, cptlhunter. That's for PayPal. Also, you can go over to my Patreon page, become a patron supporter. There you will get access to show notes. By becoming a member, you will get access to show notes, bios, and whatever goodies that my guests are having. Also, you will be helping to support the podcast. Buying new equipment, buying books so I can read them, access to different websites. I have to pay a monthly fee to keep this podcast going. So anything that you can help with would be greatly appreciated. So thank you very much in advance of your donations to help keep Captain Hunter's podcast going and growing. So that's it. Until next time, ladies and gentlemen, much love and peace.